This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So in a nutshell, here's the week. Scandal, scrutiny, and a possible sale. First, the scandal. The former Chelsea housing director pleads guilty, but leaves open questions about his connection to Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray.
That really will be the million-dollar question. Was a crime committed? And if it was, what did Tim Murray know about it?
Also, renewed scrutiny of U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz.
She has, I think, been a disappointment.
Which draws this response from Ortiz herself.
I think they're actually very inaccurate, they're unfair, and they're unwarranted.
Finally this week, the sale. The New York Times Company says it's looking for a new owner for the Boston Globe.
We need it to thrive and survive and prosper, and when you don't know who the next owner is going to be, it just creates uncertainty.
We'll dive into these stories right now with two members of our Week in Review team. Callum Borchers is the business reporter for the Boston Globe. Callum, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Also with us is WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. Good to see you, David.
Hi, Meghna.
All right, so let's start right off with the former Chelsea housing director, Michael McLaughlin, who pled guilty at a hearing in South Boston on Tuesday to four felony counts of concealing an inflated salary from federal officials. His salary was $360,000 a year, the fifth highest in the country for such housing chiefs. He concealed about $140,000 of that. He could face up to 18 months in prison, but most observers say that's very unlikely given the plea deal. So, Callum, let's start off with you. What's your reaction to Michael McLaughlin pleading out?
Yeah, the guidelines say about 12 to 18 months, and he'll probably get less than that for cooperating. But he's still not out of the woods at the state level either, of course, because he was allegedly illegally raising funds for Lieutenant Governor Timothy Murray's campaign. And I think that's really the next big question, to be honest with you. If I'm worried, anybody worried right here, it might be Murray, because McLaughlin is going to get some leniency perhaps for cooperating. And if he cooperates in the state investigation, Murray is sort of the bigger fish to fry, so to speak. So that's the guy I think might be shaking in his boots right now.
David?
Well, this is the ugly truth when you go to court in the feds and you're charged with the feds. The fact of the matter is, not all defendants are created equal. And it's classic. It's you are only as good as who you can give up. Now, you said $140,000 times 4 years, that's about $600,000. And remember, there's $7 million that are missing that they had at the housing authority that's missing. So you look at this deal and you wonder, what are the feds going to get in return for this? I mean, the name is Murray. We keep on hearing it's about Murray, and they're looking at campaign finance law violations. Is that worth it? And you look at what they're talking about in terms of the sentence recommendation that I looked at, and they're looking at the low end of the guidelines, a fine of $4,000 when you can argue either $600,000 or $7,600,000 needs to be accounted for.
Right. So, I mean, I think a lot of people have come to an agreement that this, no matter what, Tim Murray's career, future political career, does not look bright. Callum, I'm curious. Attorney General Martha Coakley is in the middle of investigating the claims about whether or not some of that money may or may not have gone into his campaign coffers. Do you, what's your sort of spidey sense telling you about whether Coakley might, shake things up even further?
Well, I think that is the big question right now. And I think that for Murray, he sort of is fighting a battle on two fronts in a way. One is, what did he know about what McLaughlin was doing at the housing authority? And then two, what did he know about McLaughlin's fundraising efforts for his campaign? So he's sort of in trouble on both of those fronts, I think.
Interesting story. We'll see how it continues to develop. But let's move on, if we can, to another legal matter. And that is an investigative series this week by our own David Boeri, in conjunction with David Frank, who's with the Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. Now, following the suicide of internet activist Aaron Swartz, who was under prosecution from U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, David and David looked deeper into Ortiz's prosecutorial record and found that what some people call a pattern of poor judgment, poor leadership, and perhaps overzealousness in her handling of lesser-known cases. So we've got a clip here from David's piece. It's with Northeastern University law professor Daniel Medwood. He's commenting on the fact that in Carmen Ortiz's 3 years in office as U.S. attorney in Massachusetts, she's already had three cases dismissed before they even went to trial due to a lack of evidence.
It's incredibly striking to have seasoned, respected judges saying, "I have never seen this. and then going so far as to put it in print in a public document. It does suggest where there's smoke, there might be fire, which is why an analysis of these cases is warranted.
And here's how Ortiz herself responded.
We have differing views. This is an adversarial system. We're here to prosecute. This is a tough business. This is not easy.
Now, David, I know that you looked at, 10 particular cases out of her case file in detail. After all your reporting and the response that you've got, I mean, do you think that there really is the evidence or image of a problem here in terms of her approach?
The evidence, people say, of the problem isn't so much that it is 10. She indicts maybe 400 cases a year. It's not the frequency. It's rather the bad conduct, people say, that those cases reveal. And perhaps how many other cases we know, we don't know how many others have that bad conduct, but it is what people say is worth looking into. And what is really striking, we're in a small legal community, and defense attorneys are very loath to criticize the office that they may be going to representing a client in search of a plea deal in the future. So the fact that so many people started talking to us openly about this was impressive to David Frank and myself.
Now, David, you've been watching the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts for a long time. I mean, is she just part and parcel of how that office has operated for decades, or is this something new?
The Department of Justice and federal prosecutions have changed over the years. There are a lot more laws. There's a lot more zealousness shown. Legislature, the Congress has created new laws. They still haven't been worked out in some cases. However, people are looking at this office in these cases, and, you know, we have Darrell Issa, the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. He has gone hard at the Department of Justice before. It is assumed that she will be going down there to testify with regard to the Aaron Swartz case. She said that she hasn't been called yet. There is an inquiry. It's assumed she's going down there. And they're going to have a lot of questions. And I think now, in terms of the Swartz question, they're going to be asking additional questions about the other cases, which people say reflect the same sorts of behavior that were in place during the Swartz case.
Callum, I'm going to come to you in just a second, but I want to play one more piece of tape from U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz herself. She was on Radio Boston speaking with Anthony on Wednesday, touching on the point that David made a little earlier, that looking at cases is one thing, but the fact is that they examine hundreds and hundreds of cases out of her office every year, and you have to take that into account.
Given the number of cases that we do hear, and not only that we bring and we charge and proceed with in court, but also the number of investigations that we look at that don't result in charges, or the investigations that we end up declining. So there's a lot of work that we do that the public and certainly the court system never sees.
And Callum, this is a very active court that we're talking about, lots of high-profile cases. So I'm just wondering what you make of this deeper analysis that David Boyer and David Frank have done about Carmen Ortiz herself.
Well, terrific reporting, first of all, David.
But, thank you.
I'm struck by sort of an inherent inconsistency, I feel, in Ortiz's response there, which is that, you know, part of the problem is, as her critics have put it, is just not exercising great judgment always in deciding which cases to pursue. And so if her explanation is we're so busy, we have so many coming in, well, then the follow-up question is, well, then why not be more selective? And I'll share an example from personal experience. I was working a couple of years ago on an investigative report about green card marriages, where you had Americans who were accepting money from illegal immigrants. You'd have a fake marriage so that the immigrant could get into the country. And we had these Homeland Security experts telling us, you know, this is potentially dangerous. You never know who's coming in, and they're getting to stay here. And what we found was that while the immigrants, if they were exposed, were deported, the Americans who engaged in the schemes were almost always getting off scot-free. And we wondered why Ortiz's office wasn't prosecuting them. And we basically got the explanation you just heard from her, which is we're very busy. We have a lot of cases to handle, and we can't follow everyone. We have to decide which ones are important. And so you scratch your head and think, well, you know, why leave those cases alone and yet go after a guy who was downloading academic documents from MIT?
So let's move on finally to the news that broke yesterday. The New York Times company is putting the Boston Globe up for sale for the second time in 4 years. The Times purchased the Globe in 1993 for $1.1 billion. Estimates right now are that the resale price have been hovering around $100 million, or a tenth of that price. Callum, I'm really interested to hear from you first as a Globe reporter. What's the response over there in the newsroom?
We're not feeling very valuable right now. No, but we had a sober meeting this morning, as some of you have read about. Beth Healy and Casey Ross have been doing some good reporting on this subject. We had a Times executive, Michael Golden, down to meet with us as a staff today. And it was, as I said, it was a sober meeting. There were moments of levity and laughs, but, you know, he essentially reminded us that, you know, the New York Times company is just that. It's a publicly traded company with a fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders to get the best value it can for them in this sale. And so a lot of the questions coming from staffers had to do with hypotheticals. Well, if you have a local buyers group and they're very committed to preserving the integrity of the paper and its legacy, but their bid is a little bit less than a private equity company that plans to break it up or something like that, you know, what do you do? And, you know, understandably, it's a very difficult question, and we weren't able to get, you know, an absolute concrete answer. And, you know, that's somewhat unnerving to some folks.
Sure. In fact, we heard earlier this week from Ken Doctor. He's a newspaper industry analyst who talks about the relatively low price that the Globe could sell for. But he made a point about what's more important in this whole transaction. Let's listen.
That's a relatively small price to pay for the prestige and really the power of the Boston Globe. The money is the money, and they may get a higher bid from one bidder than another, but will they apply a civic interest as well to try to be a good steward as they pass the Globe to someone else?
David, good steward, this is the big question. The Globe is an incredibly important institution in this city. You know, yeah, how do we define good steward?
Unfortunately, you go back to the numbers. Despite what you're talking of good steward, they put it up for sale in 1999, and they got a bid of $33 million. That's after it was sold by the Taylor family. Talk about sell high. Buy low. They sold it for $1.1 billion. And so 99, it was $33 million. Then, of course, they needed to remove the pension liability. So they got the unions, the printers unions, to make all kinds of concessions and then didn't sell it. So now $100 million perhaps. The one thing that Forbes magazine did rather thoughtfully, I thought, was they listed five Massachusetts people who are in the top 400 in terms of wealth, including two Johnsons, Bob Kraft and Jim Davis, at a mere $2.1 billion as part of the top 229 Americans. And so they're thinking it's for one of them, maybe.
Mm. Well, Callum, you all do good work over there. Here's hoping that a good steward indeed, whoever ends up buying the Globe, is a good steward indeed.
Amen to that.
Mm. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs, and Callum, I'm going to let you be our leadoff batter here to lighten the mood a bit.
All right, Megda. Well, this should lighten things up a bit. As you know, I love to bring the sports into it, and I'm not a huge NASCAR fan, but this weekend, like a lot of folks, I'll be watching with some interest as Danica Patrick tries to become the first woman to win the Daytona 500. We know that she's already made history this week. She was the fastest qualifier and will be the pole sitter this weekend, which means that she will be starting in the first position. But I thought that that certainly hasn't slipped under the radar, but I thought that it would be a good week to remember Janet Guthrie, who is often forgotten, but in 1977, she was actually the first woman to race in the Daytona 500, period, and actually did very, very well. She was on her way to a top 10 finish before she blew out two valves in her engine with 10 laps to go. She still finished 12th, which is the best finish ever by a woman in the Daytona 500. That's the mark that Danica Patrick will be trying to beat this week.
What a story!
Yeah, but you left out one thing that Danica Patrick has done that nobody else has yet done. Did you ever see Mario Andretti in this Sports Illustrated swimwear issue?
You know, I'm happy to say I missed that one.
So. As the woman in the room, does it matter what she looks like in a swimsuit? No, she can drive fast. That's all I have to say. David, your hubbub.
Well, it's been a very bleak week for me. So here is something with this winter storm coming on tomorrow, a note about springtime. Researchers in England have discovered just recently that flowers use electrical fields to attract bumblebees. This brings me back to my former career studying the sexual pollination of flowers as a botanist. And, you know, it's just a reminder, flowers in their own way are pretty smart. The fact is they've been around for 25 million years, which is about 24 million years longer than we have. We've only been using electricity for about 120 years. They've been using it for about 25 million to attract bumblebees. So while spring can't come soon enough, I think it's time for a tip of the hat to the power of flowers.
Flower of power, a whole new definition for the term. Terrific. Anthony, what do you have to say today?
All right, so this is an item. Callum, tip of the hat to you from one of your correspondents earlier this week. Something about self-entitled children and I guess putting parents on notice. Apparently a 10-year-old Brockton boy dialed 911. Why? Because he didn't want to go to bed, and his mother was trying to get him to go to bed. So he dialed 911. He dropped the phone, I guess, before the dispatcher answered. The mother picked up the phone, and this is all recorded, and you can hear the mother saying, do you want to talk to the police? Because you can't be calling 911 when there's no emergency, because they need for the people who actually are in trouble. The dispatcher apparently expressed understanding, but said that she'd have to be sending a police officer out anyway. So I'm not sure who this officer came to the rescue of, the distressed mother or the distressed child who had to go to bed. But that should have been an interesting encounter, and I hope it all turned out okay.
Young listeners out there, don't get any ideas. My hubbub to wrap things up today has to do with the world of comics and Julia Child, who is being featured in a series of comic books called Female Force. It is a comic series that has had very famous and intriguing women featured in it, such as Hillary Clinton, Anne Rice, Olivia Newton-John, and Condoleezza Rice. This one is going to be called, it's going to feature a 32-page comic tracing Julia Child's long and illustrious life, bringing cooking to the world. And actually, I was looking at a small picture of this, and I have to say, they do a terrible job with her likeness, unfortunately. But if you didn't want to cook but you like comics, this is a way to go forward with that. So that's my hubbub for today. And on that note, Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Always fun. Thanks for having me.
And David Bowery, WBUR senior reporter. Thank you so much for your great reporting and for being here today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And stay with us. Coming up, an Oscar-nominated documentary exposes the devastating prevalence of sexual assault in the U.S. military. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.